And now, ladies and gentlemen, we have from the great state of California, the one who has stood shoulder to shoulder with Senator Hubert Humphrey, regardless of party affiliations, who will be escorted to the platform by my political campaign managing son, Michael Mitchell. This is Senator Thomas Kuchel of the state of California. Ladies and gentlemen, although we have numerous operations that we are carrying on in this convention, the United States Senate is also still operating, and for that reason, it is going to be necessary to expedite this a little in order that the majority whip may go over and perform his duties, and the minority whip may also go to keep an eye on what the majority whip does. So I'm going to follow the Senate practice of recognizing first the majority party and the person with a greater seniority. Both have the same kind of hearts and interest in this. The only thing that makes a difference is the years of service. And I shall first introduce the Senator from Minnesota, and thereafter, when he finishes, I shall introduce the Senator from California. I would like to explain that it may be necessary for them to leave before we finish, because as I said, the Senate will convene, but this is not a discourtesy. This is because they must be there to start the wheels turning. Before I present them, I want to call attention to the fact that seated on the platform and walking, Claude, don't leave, have a seat. I want to call attention to the fact that we have exhibits here of what has helped to make this civil rights victory possible. I had hoped that Sam Jackson could be around, but I don't see him. I guess he must be somewhere in the audience. If he is here, I wish he'd come up to the platform. But as you know, the vote of those who believe in civil rights is very great in certain parts of this country. And then there are parts of the country where it is not very great. And if we are able to get any assistance from the persons who are elected from those states, it must be because there is leadership among those who believe in civil rights, regardless of race, regardless of religion, and regardless of national origin. I'm not going to ask these people to stand, but I want to identify them so you'll know who they are and why we have them here. Seated on the far right is Dr. Geraldine Woods, the president of the Delta Sigma Theta sorority. And the reason she is here is because the Deltas, throughout all of their regional meetings, she happens to come from your state, Senator Kuchel, and this is why I guess she's so good. But in any event, throughout all of the fight on civil rights, in each of their regional meetings, they have asked every single one of the hundreds of delegates who have attended at a given point to sit down and write letters to their senators and then march in a body by the hundreds to the mailboxes and mail these letters. And seated next to her is one of those rarities in the city of Washington. This is a gentleman who was the regional director of the wartime FEPC, who was the executive secretary of Stiles Hall at the University of California in Berkeley, And upon his retirement, along with his good wife, Mrs. Ruth Kingman, began what is called a citizens' lobby here in the city of Washington. They come from the state of California each year at their own expense. They take charge of making contacts with all of the members of the West Coast delegation in the House, and they take the responsibility for helping to coordinate all of the activities with respect to the mountain states and others where we do not have much of a following, and that is Mr. Harry Kingman of Berkeley, California. And seated next to him is one of the reasons why, when I talk with Senator Humphrey and others, I'm able to say that I know that we can expect a vote from a certain source, not because I have a crystal ball or any influence, but because I know people who are the sincere friends and supporters of certain senators and who, as a matter of principle, not because of pressure, but as a matter of principle, get from them certain commitments. And so there came a time when we were wondering what was going to happen with reference to the vote of the senator from Colorado, Mr. Dominick, on the cloture vote. I had peace of mind because this next lady, Mrs. Barbara Coopersmith, was his campaign worker out there in the state, and she had been assured by him that he would be with us in the critical hour. And of course, it is with sentiment because my first son was born in the state of Minnesota, and love for that great state, which has been accentuated by the works of its good senior senator, that we have here today, because he too has worked diligently for this cause, Mr. Donald Lewis, who is the president of the St. Paul, Minnesota branch of NACP. And of course, Claude doesn't like for me to say this so much, but it's so complimentary that I do say it. I'll soften it up a little, Claude. But he was formerly in the state of Louisiana, Senator Humphrey and Senator Kuchel. And he was just an ordinary person like me down there in Louisiana. And they made life so tough for him, wouldn't treat him right. And he finally decided to leave that state, went to your great state of California, and is now not only a national NACP board member and a great worker for civil rights, but president of a multi-million dollar savings and loan association. All I can say is I'm sure that the state of Louisiana would be very delighted to try to get him back, but I know it's not possible at this time. And now comes a wonderful moment that I cherish very much. And I cherish this moment because it is one where I have an opportunity to say the things that I've longed so often to be able to say as I sat in the Senate gallery listening to what was going on the floor below. The gentleman that I'm about to introduce is one of the summertime, wintertime, springtime, fall, all-time fighters for civil rights. His fight began at a time when he was a rising young man at the crossroads of life, when he could have elected to go along with those forces that will make you great as long as you will ignore principle. But he decided to take the crossroad that led through a lot of rough underbrush and over a lot of rocky ground and to undertake to do the thing which would lead to the heights of human betterment. And so, as mayor of a great city of Minneapolis, he took the position that in that city there should be civil rights for all of its people and that there should be no discrimination whatsoever. It happened that he went to the great Democratic National Convention. This was a convention where people were walking out of the convention because they didn't like this or that. And he carried the banner of civil rights when it was hard to carry it at that time. Then he became a senator from his state. And when he came down here, he had to make the choice whether he would be a good senator, not offending anybody, not stepping on any toes, and become a part of the club and rise to a position of importance by being nice, or whether he would continue, though a member of the United States Senate, to espouse and support the principles in which he believes. And so he continued to do that. And by the grace of God and the power and gratitude of the people, he has become one of the chief, and I like to use the word chiefest because I think that is more descriptive of his position. He has become one of the chiefest persons of importance in the United States Senate. Through this long, hard fight, he has never lost his temper. He has never operated as in a partisan way. He has stood on the floor of the United States Senate, worked patiently with the opposition. He has battled for the passage of this bill, winning those who were lukewarm and those who were not at all converted. And in the great hour of triumph the other night, when we had just finished holding a meeting with him, my teammate Joe Rao and I had just left him, and we were discussing an amendment that we didn't like, and Joe came back to me in the Senate gallery and said, "Clarence, something bad has happened." And I thought, of course, he meant the amendment, and I bristled. He said, "It's not the amendment." He said, "We have had a serious development in the state of Minnesota affecting the senator's son." And in those kinds of things, you just don't know what kind of words to use. But I went into the office with Joe, and all we could do was clasp hands and put an arm around the shoulder and express in wordless appreciation the mutual feelings of sympathy that were flowing between understanding hearts. But in spite of his personal problem affecting the health of his son, who was in Minnesota, our courageous and effective champion of civil rights put on his fighting gear, put on his winning smile, and marched down to the Senate floor so that the United States Senate, by a vote of 73-27, would put its stamp of approval on the strongest civil rights bill in the history of this country. And so I present to you the Honorable Hubert Humphrey, Senior Senator from the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much, my dear friend Clarence Mitchell. And thank you, Senator Kuchel, and all of our good friends of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. And I want to extend a particular greeting to my fellow Minnesotans that have come to this convention. We're very proud of our organization in Minnesota. And I've had a long association, both as a friend and a member, of the NAACP in the state of Minnesota. I'm particularly happy to be here on the 55th annual convention. This isn't my first experience, I might add, at your conventions. I can recall several, and I recall, for example, with great emotion and good feeling the time we were together in New York, I believe it was in 1960, and the meetings that you've had in Minnesota, and I hope you enjoyed your visits to our state. And to be here with you in Washington today is a privilege that I've looked forward to enjoying for many, many months. First of all, I want to thank you for coming to Washington at this very propitious moment. I attend many meetings in Washington, and I know there are many lobbying activities that take place in Washington, because this is the seat of government, the center of political power in this great nation. And I can think of no meeting that could be more helpful and meaningful at this crucial hour in our nation's history than this particular gathering. And I can And I can tell you that it is a wonderful feeling to know that you're here for but one purpose. No special privilege, no special interest, but that you're here for the good of this republic, for the extension of full freedom to every American citizen. I miss President Spingarn, but I understand that he's away. And I'm so delighted to see my old friend Roy Wilkins. I mustn't say old friend, my young friend Roy Wilkins. And I've been seeing so much of Clarence that I began to think that he's the senator. But I'm going to let you in on a secret that very few people know. Of course, if very few people know it, why, it's seldom a secret. But if you'll just pause with me for a moment. Roy Wilkins is a graduate of the University of Minnesota. And he is, as you know, one of what we call the distinguished Minnesotans, having been awarded that high honor by the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. And one of the reasons that Clarence Mitchell is such a great man, such a fine personality, and so effective and persuasive and convincing is because he too is from Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota. And of course, I attribute the success of his son to the fact that he too was from Minnesota. And I might add that the reason that Senator Kuchel is the remarkable, able, effective, dynamic personality that he is because his beautiful, lovely, gracious wife is from Minnesota. And then to give you the prize, mind you, the minority leader of the Senate of the United States went to the University of Minnesota, Everett Dirksen. And lest I forget it, so did Hubert Humphrey. So I hope you won't think I'm exaggerating or I'm being too egocentric if I should say that it was the Minnesota team that put the Civil Rights Bill across in the Senate. I see Joe Rao came in. Well, he didn't go to Minnesota, but we let him in whenever he wants to come in. Well, there are many others here that I should single out for just a word of happy reference. And this is a happy occasion, even though it's a very sobering one. Some of us, well, you, my dear friends, have been at this work for years. And if I may say so with some element of truth, I'm not exactly a newcomer to this cause, as was said by Clarence. But the truth is that we're really meeting here at the headwaters, or to put it as we would in our part of the country, the watershed of history. And you're meeting at a time that the American people have made a great decision, because the American people are turning their backs on a tormented and unhappy yesterday, and they're turning their faces towards the bright sunshine of tomorrow. You may recall when I asked my political party in Philadelphia in 1948 to walk out of the shadows of states' rights and to march forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights. And now, ladies and gentlemen, this is no longer a party issue, and it never should have been. This is the great moral issue of our century, the great national issue of our time. And the American people, and may I restate it, the American people, the overwhelming majority, of the American people are happy that their Congress, the duly elected representatives of the Congress of the United States, have taken the decision to close the door upon bigotry and prejudice and discrimination and open up the door of human rights. Oh, yes, the Civil Rights Bill is no longer a dream, no longer just a legislative proposal. The fact is, it's about to become the law of the land. Only this morning at the White House, we were discussing this, and somebody said, how come the dateline July 4th got attached to this bill? Well, I said, Mr. President, if you permit me, I was at Fisk University receiving an honorary degree. Gee, that was a great day, too. Had a lot of great days. And I said that it seemed to me fitting and appropriate that the Congress ought to bind up its work on this, the great civil rights issue, by at least the 4th of July, because this would bring new meaning, fresh meaning, to the Declaration of Independence, that great document. That great document that expressed for all humanity the truth of those certain inalienable rights, God-given rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I am confident that we're going to meet that deadline. And what a happy day that will be. I wish that Mary White Ovington or Dr. Henry Moskowitz or William English Walling, great leaders of our organization, could have lived to see this day. And I guess one of the reasons that I have a deep and abiding religious faith is that I still think that they are seeing this day. I think they would have joined with us in congratulating Roy Wilkins and congratulating Clarence Mitchell and in congratulating all the members of the NAACP staff, particularly its legal division and those that have associated with it, and all of the hundreds of thousands of its members. What a happy day it would have been for these early pioneers. And I wish to say, as a representative in Congress, a word of thanks to you. You have performed a mighty task for democracy, and we are indebted to you. And others I know have labored with you. There are newer organizations in the Negro community. There are these many good and solid liberal and progressive groups, the labor forces, the labor unions, business leaders, education leaders, and the churches. Oh, my fellow Americans, how fortunate it is for this nation that those who have lifted their voices for equality of opportunity and for human freedom have been those who have been the spiritual leaders of the many faiths in this nation. How fortunate for American democracy that those who were the spokesmen for divine providence spoke for humanity in this crucial hour. I wonder how many Americans fully appreciate this fact. We didn't have to have leadership from demagogues. Leadership for this great fight for freedom came from the people, came from the heart and the mind and the soul of our people. And I, for one, am ever grateful and ever indebted to the religious leaders of Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish faith for the fact that they had the courage of the apostles of old to stand up and speak for God's children. How fortunate. And if you'll pardon me, and I hope my good friend Senator Kuchel will join me in this, as I know he will, I'd like to claim a little credit this moment for the Congress of the United States and even the Senate. You know what? I think we may have done almost as well as you had hoped, and possibly a little bit better than you had feared. But I'm talking to trusted old soldiers in this battle for freedom. You went into this battle first, 55 years ago to be exact. And you've been in the forefront of that struggle ever since, 55 years of organized effort. I've said to so many of my young friends, it takes patience, but persevering patience. It takes resoluteness to win these great struggles. So I think that today you're entitled to take special satisfaction in the outcome. Now, satisfaction, yes. We're not going to stop, you know, with just being satisfied with yesterday's achievements. You can have your satisfaction, and I have mine on this issue, but surcease in our labors, no. I think I know you too well to imagine for a moment that you will rest on your oars or yesterday's honors or victories. For the truth is that our work has just begun and there's work to be done. And that work is for today and for tomorrow and for the years ahead. We've got a lot of catching up to do. You know, 10 years ago, the Supreme Court handed down its historic decision against segregation in the schools. We've celebrated that decision this year. And 10 years ago, a great opportunity to win prompt and widespread compliance with that decision, I regret to say, was lost. All over the South, there were men and women, yes, white men and women, of goodwill who welcomed that decision. Oh, I imagine a minority, but a very significant, thoughtful minority. And all over the South, there were men and women, and in great number, who thought the court was too hasty, too drastic, or even wrong in its decision. But these were men and women who were willing to comply with the decision because it was the law, and they were law-abiding citizens. And together, these groups may well have been a majority in most, if not all, of the southern states. We do not know, of course, because regrettably, no genuine, full national effort was made to mobilize them. The trumpet that should have been sounded gave forth a very uncertain sound, and only a few prepared themselves for battle. The forces of bigotry, the forces of prejudice, and the advocates of massive resistance seized the initiative. And the men of moderation and goodwill were driven back because the leadership throughout the nation was divided or muted. And so it was left to a handful of children to show them the courage and the determination that too many of their elders and some of them in high places failed to show. I'm often reminded of that famous and moving passage in Scripture, "A little child shall lead them." And these American children, attractive, healthy, intelligent, they walked to school through the jeering mobs. They stayed in school despite the hostility for the moment of some of their classmates. And they won the respect of their teachers and their schoolmates by their determination to get the very best education that was available. And last week, as we know, just to cite one student who represents so many, Jacqueline Faye Evans, graduated with an A-plus average in her final year in high school and was named to the National Honor Society. And her high school, a predominantly white one, was in Little Rock, where only 7 years ago, federal troops had to be called in to enforce the desegregation decision. Oh, we can be proud of Jacqueline. Jacqueline Evans demonstrated the kind of constructive courage that we adults need. No demagoguery, no irresponsibility, but firmness and dedication to principle. No rancor, no hatred, no bitterness, but a love of humanity and a desire to succeed and prove to even those who doubted the most that the decision of that court would be vindicated in the life of a child in an American school. Now, all credit, therefore, to Jacqueline Evans and to others like her. But I say most regrettably and yet respectfully, and every one of us are somewhat at fault. If not you, then I must claim some of the fault. Had the Congress, the federal government, the White House given prompt and effective leadership 10 years ago, I think this past decade might have been much less troubled. And I do believe that we would have been further along with our program of eliminating discrimination. Now today, we cannot spend our time looking on the yesterdays. Today, I'm happy to say that we have in government, in the Congress, on both parties, and in the White House, those who do not float above the battle, but who are entering into the struggle. And I'm very happy to say that the President of the United States, with his responsibilities as chief executive of this great United States of America, has been and will continue to be, as our president, an effective leader in the effort to get this civil rights bill implemented and into action. He will not dither, he will decide. He will not agonize, he will act. And I can assure you that he will act and act promptly to mobilize all men and women of goodwill. I think that he appreciates deeply the support of this distinguished progressive American that's here on this platform with me today, Senator Kuchel of California. I know that the President is ever respectful and grateful to Senator Kuchel and the magnificent leadership of Senator Dirksen, Republicans, to make this bill a reality. And you can expect this government, the executive and the legislative levels, to mobilize the forces of goodwill in this nation, north and south, east and west, to secure implementation of the Civil Rights Act. You know, friends, the American community needs unity today more than ever before. And I want to caution this audience, those voices in America, from wherever they may come, that seek to divide us, those voices that seek to pit race against race, or section against section, or group against group, those voices are unworthy of the American people and the American heritage. We're faced with tremendous problems throughout the world. We have unbelievable difficulties. yet to be met. We're confronted with powerful adversaries in every corner of the world, and we have immense and staggering problems at home. Therefore, what America needs is the best that's in every American. And what we need, therefore, is the full participation, the full citizenship participation of every American, regardless of race, color, or creed. I guess this is just another way of telling you we have a lot to do. You know, as the former mayor of a great city of Minneapolis, and I like to remember that we did pass the first enforceable municipal fair employment practices ordinance. I like to remember that. And by the way, I don't want to forget that the gentleman who is now the Secretary of Agriculture, Mr. Freeman, was then my legal counsel. As the mayor of Minneapolis, I was the old man. I was 33. And he was about 26. And he was the legal counsel. He wasn't on the payroll. We didn't have any money, but he was doing it for nothing. He just graduated from law school. And he wrote the legal language. You know, the lawyers have a way of writing things that some of us laymen can't understand right away. He wrote the legal language that was ultimately presented to the Minneapolis City Council for the first enforceable fair employment practices ordinance in the United States of America. And we passed it. And it works. And the city is all the better for it. Well, as a result of this background, I've urged the United States Conference of Mayors to call a general conference of all of its members to see what can be done to more effectively and judiciously implement and effectuate the program of the civil rights legislation. A high responsibility rests upon these men, these city officials, and they can fulfill it more fully and effectively if they counsel together. Now, some of my friends are saying that this is going to be a long, hot summer. Well, it's always hot in Washington in the summer. It's even occasionally warm in Minnesota. And it's always much longer than we members of Congress wish that it was. Now, that may be the case, long and hot, but I should say it should be a long, busy, and constructive summer as well. No doubt many of our fellow citizens will be out demonstrating on the streets, many of you even in this audience. And let me say that so long as these demonstrations represent the right of petition, the right of the American people to seek redress of their grievances, and so long as they are within the great Gandhian tradition of nonviolence and of law and order, the tradition to which you and the NAACP have so patiently and heroically, faithfully adhered to, I think that they may well serve a good purpose. But I would also like to see the national, state, and local officials of this great American organization. And let me underscore it, a fine, loyal, decent organization. And all the other organizations of the civil rights movement, I'd like to see those officials spending even more time consulting with and working with the leaders of our country in the halls of government. More time than on the streets. And why do I say it? Because the decisions are now going to be made at the administrative level. And my dear friends, you are respected American citizens. And your voice needs to be heard not only in the boulevards, but more importantly, your voice needs to be heard around the conference table of the officials of our government. I would like to see your officers invited to the offices of the mayors, the governors, and the offices of every federal department of our government. I would like to see you invited to give your advice and help in translating the provisions of the Civil Rights Act from words on the statute books into living realities in our cities, our states, and in our nation. And I know of no group that could give more wise counsel more judicious counsel, more restrained and responsible counsel than the men and the women who have led this great organization. And you can be trusted, and I do trust you. You see, I believe that the key to our success is a living, working partnership. A partnership between all Americans, white and Negro, every religious faith. The NAACP was built through this partnership when, in the words of Mary White Offington, the leaders of the Niagara Movement, quote, brought their energy and ability into the service of the association, end of quote. It was this working partnership which secured the enactment of the Civil Rights Act. It wasn't done by Congress alone. You had a hand in it, and a big one. And it is this kind of partnership which will make this act work. Now, I've spoken of today's long delayed but welcome triumph and of the challenge of our immediate tomorrow. And now just a few concluding words on the day after tomorrow. It does little good to open doors if we're not ready to step through them. And it does little good to open doors if they open into empty space. And that's why we should keep our eyes fixed on the day after tomorrow. That's why this great civil rights movement, with its unprecedented dedication and dynamism, must enlist in the battle for a better America, all across the board, for a better and a more adequate educational system, and must enlist in this great national war against poverty and illiteracy and disease in this nation that has been called for by the President of the United States. I don't need to preach to you about the value of education. We know that. The trouble is, my dear friends, that everyone hasn't quite gotten the message. I think that you appreciate it more than many other Americans because you've had to work so hard to get it for many of your children and for yourselves. In the past, the tragedy has been that the self-sacrifice of Negro parents has yielded so much less than it ought to. Too many doors were shut even against the educated Negro. And the Negro college student or college graduate for too many years could expect to earn in his life, yes, in his whole lifetime, less than a white man who had even finished the eighth grade. These are the economic facts. Now, my dear friends, the hour of change has arrived. Some new doors are opening, and more of these doors will be opening every day as the Civil Rights Act takes effect. The truth is that today opportunity greets the college graduate, and opportunity welcomes the skilled worker. This means that our educational system must be strengthened, it must be expanded, and it must be designed to meet the needs of contemporary living and contemporary industry and job opportunities. And this must be done from the elementary schools right up through higher education. And ladies and gentlemen, it can't be done without federal assistance. It's going to need the help of the Congress of the United States. And then let me encourage you to place stress upon quality as well as quantity. For in this age of scientific revolution and automation, there is less and less place for the half-educated or the poorly educated, no matter what the color of the skin. There must be one standard that we want for our young people. There must be one standard that we insist upon for our educational institutions, not merely the standard of integration, but the standard of excellence of teaching and excellence of curriculum an excellence of performance. To ask for less is to sell out even before the struggle begins. Now, we have come, therefore, to realize that school is not an island, but a vital part of the society that surrounds it. No child can have real equal educational opportunity if he comes from a family living for year in and year out on relief in some urban slum, or if his father is an unemployed miner or sharecropper or common laborer. This isn't equality. This is like putting shackles on that child's feet. No child has an equal educational opportunity if he comes to school ill-fed, sick, or ill-clothed, or if he's compelled to do his homework in a household in which poverty is the constant, unwelcome guest. Talented and determined children, I know, have overcome these obstacles. There are always those great dramatic stories of how one has risen up out of all of this misery. All the more credit to them, but there is no sense and no purpose in making this upward road so difficult. Poverty does not ennoble those who suffer from it, least of all those who suffer from it when the general society is unbelievably prosperous. Poverty is a bitter cup which poisons all who drink from it. And I know that poverty has always been with us, and we're going to hear political spokesmen say that there's little that you can do about it, that the poor have always been with us. I know that poverty is not new, but I also know that there is something that is new. We now have the means to do something about poverty. We have the knowledge, we have the resources, for the first time in our history, to banish poverty from the face of this great republic of ours. All we need is the will. We need to make up our mind that we're going to do something about this, just as you made up your mind in this organization 55 years ago, that this day would approach. And that will must be organized. A will to put our knowledge and our resources to work. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've confronted the issue, the moral issue. And America today is the better because we've examined deep into our conscience and our soul. We are not playing or talking or working with a partisan issue. And I say with a note of reverence and prayer, pray God that this never becomes a partisan issue. We can't afford that. And I believe that America will give an honorable place in the chapters of history to those who have put party second place and put country first. And I'm honored to be in the presence of people of many political persuasions, liberal and conservative, progressive, Republican, Democratic, but who have had one common goal, the attainment of human dignity, the respect for human dignity, and the attainment of full freedom for all of our people. As the roll call was being tabulated the other evening in the Senate, I took out of my desk a notebook, and I wrote just a few little lines there, just a few brief lines. I said, what does America mean to me? It was a moment for reflection. I was confident that we had the victory. It was only a question of how large the victory, how big. As I had said earlier in the day, it was not a time for rejoicing in the streets, but rather for sober joy, reflecting upon our new duties and our new responsibilities in the days ahead. I said then, and I repeat now, that I would hate to believe that our fight for equality would have been obtained, the victory would have been obtained at the expense of community. I believe in the American community. I believe in the promise of this land. I believe that the main strength, the real strength of America, is its ideals. I believe that the message of the American conscience and of the American tradition of equality of opportunity and of human freedom is our most powerful force in the struggle which is being waged in the world today. Many people have said that this is a conflict of ideas. It's not just ideas. It's a conflict of ideals. And the real struggle in the world today is over the question and over this fundamental moral issue of human dignity. This is what separates the free man from the totalitarian. This is what separates those who believe in the sanctity or the dignity of the individual from those who look upon him as but a servant of the state. The great fundamental political, moral, spiritual issue, now as in the centuries that have preceded us, is the nature of man. Is he but chemistry, flesh and bone? Or is he a spark, or does he possess within himself a spark of the infinite? I believe he does. I believe that the reason that we fight for freedom, the reason people have died for freedom, the reason that we've believed in freedom, is because it is a matter of our spiritual makeup. It's a part of our soul. In fact, it is the connection. This human dignity, this element of human dignity, is the contact between man and his maker. So as I sat there and thought, what does America mean to me? Many things raced through my mind. Oh yes, it means a Bunker Hill and Lexington and Concord and Appomattox. It means victory in World War I and World War II. It means the heavy burdens of leadership in these post-war years. But those are the more of the spectacular remembrances and memories of our beautiful America. I think what America means to me more than anything else is the fact that it represents a concept of life in which a little person has the opportunity to become a great person. It represents justice. One of the most precious words in the lexicon of democracy. America means to me people, not white people and colored people, not Catholic and Protestant or Jew, but people. And America means to me freedom. Freedom to do, not merely freedom from. Not merely freedom from want and freedom from fear, but freedom to live and freedom to grow and freedom to enjoy the fruits of life. America represents conscience. And whenever this nation gets to a point where its conscience is not troubled by its injustices or its inequities, then America is dead. And America represents to me the pursuit of happiness. The living of the good life. Not just life that is survival, because that's unworthy of God's children. But the life that is rich, and the life that is full, and the life that is meaningful, and the life that is filled with the opportunity to do even better than anyone ever dreamed possible. And I want to thank this wonderful organization for keeping alive this flame, not spark, but this flame of American conscience, for keeping alive this meaning of the America that we cherish and that we love. And I salute you for a job well done. I commend you for courage and patience. I commend you for trust and faith in the ultimate sense of justice on the part of those that you have elected to serve you in the halls of Congress, in the legislatures, and in the executive branch of government. And I beseech you never to lose that faith. I ask you to instill it even deeper into us for the difficult jobs that yet lie ahead. Thank you very much.